It's time for Mac Break Weekly. I can't believe it. We've never had Jim Dalrymple on the show. The editor-in-chief of loopinsight.com joins us.
Yep.
And Renee Ritchie and Andy Iannocco. We'll talk about the latest Apple quarterly results, the Apple Watch, the newest version of OS 10, and no, we're not going to talk about Windows 10. It's all next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth is provided by CashFly. Pay as you go and start with 2 terabytes free by going to cashfly.com. Use the promo code TWIT. This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 465, recorded Tuesday, July 28th, 2015. Inside Windows 10, not. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by JustWorks.com. JustWorks helps businesses take care of their benefits, payroll, and HR with intuitive software. Just visit JustWorks.com and enter offer code MACBREAK to receive 15% off your first year of services. And by LegalZoom. Protect your family with a last will or living trust today. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but can connect you with an independent attorney. Visit LegalZoom.com and use the offer code MBW in the referral box at checkout for your special discount. And by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost automated investment service that's the most sophisticated way for you to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit Wealthfront.com/MacBreak to sign up and get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's Wealthfront.com/MacBreak. It's time for MacBreak Weekly, the show where we cover the latest news from Apple. Andy Iannocco, as always, or almost always, part of the regulars here. Good to see you. Are you wearing a white band with your Apple Watch?
Yes, I got the Stormtrooper edition.
Fluoro elastomer. I took your advice and I got a cheapo leather band, which I really like. A red leather band looks just like the classic buckle minus the cost.
They're pretty
very
good.
Happy.
It's,
yeah.
You got to love the Apple design to go for $150 for a leather band. They're really nice, but yikes.
Yeah, they look. I mean, of course, I'm sure they're better made and all of that. Mr. Renee Ritchie from iMore.com wearing his WWDC last year hat.
Yes, yeah, because my hair looks like a triple dyed on my head this morning. So I put this on. And also, I thought it would counteract Dalrymple's Bruins hat if he was wearing one.
Don't taunt the man. He's actually in a bad mood, I think. But we'll find
He's
out.
Be on heavens.
Jim Dalrymple, loopinsight.com. It's good to have you on the show.
Good to be here, Leo.
Thank you for joining us.
I don't know about your other guests, but, you know.
Hey, they're all right, really. It looks like you're outside enjoying the weather.
I am.
Nice. Very nice. Well, I'm glad you could do that. Nitrozak and Snaggy explained what happened to poor Mr. Dalrymple when he lost those thousands of songs. According to, do you see my screen? Nitrozak and Snaggy, his songs must have slipped out of his pockets, got lost in his couch, where the cleaners inadvertently vacuumed them up and sent them to the fifth dimension, who put them on a soul train with Ozzy Osbourne driving the crazy train. Then they went through the desert on a horse with no name, where they were searching for a heart of gold, but that took them for a walk on the wild side, where they saw the needle and the damage done, after which they were stuck inside a mobile. Actually, that mobile with the Memphis Blues again. A nice picture of Jim. And see, Apple Music makes perfect sense now, doesn't it?
Yep.
Looks just like that.
Coming into Los Angeles, bringing in a couple of authorization keys.
Sorry. It's a good explanation as any, I mean, to their credit.
So give us an update, Jim, because the last, you seemed like you found most of them, but I think you got some extra help.
Well, I did go in and see Apple, but a lot of what happened was based on iTunes Match. So the way that iTunes Match used to work is that you would enable iTunes Match. It would show you your purchases, your uploaded files, and your matched files. Well, when they made Apple Music, the iTunes Match service now only shows you your purchase files. So Apple Music wasn't working well for me. There were some bugs and, you know, duplicated files.
Wait
and
a minute.
Files showing up.
Say that again. What? iTunes Match now doesn't show stuff I've uploaded, only stuff I purchased from iTunes?
Right. But iTunes Match, there's an option in iTunes now to turn on iCloud Music Library. iCloud Music Library includes your uploaded songs and your matched songs and your purchased songs.
Now, I understand the confusion.
The way that I always used iTunes Match was I turn on iTunes Match and it showed all of those three categories of songs for me. So when Apple Music was showing me some you know, bugs or whatever was going on there, I turned off Apple Music, turned off iCloud Music Library, because that is part, as far as I knew, that was part of Apple Music. So I'm left with my library of songs, but they're not all there. So they were there the whole time, because iTunes Match is now part of iCloud Music Library. And there are some, there's a couple hundred songs now that are missing that I guess I deleted myself. When I was trying to get rid of Apple Music, you know, Apple pointed out that I guess I deleted them.
They said the songs never went anywhere, Jim.
Never went anywhere.
Yeah.
Except the ones that I deleted. So the songs that I deleted, I'm going to go back in and rebuy.
Yeah.
Because they were my Aussie collection and my Black Sabbath collection, which is, I think there's about 200 songs.
You had hypothesized that it was because you had the same song on two albums, on the original album and a compilation, things like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's very confusing to me. I know that I downloaded a compilation of Ozzy and a couple of compilations of Black Sabbath. So when I decided that I would just delete them altogether, get rid of Apple Music, I went in and deleted those songs. So I'm not sure if I deleted the compilation and Apple Music associated that with my files and deleted those, or if I actually downloaded, you know, these individual Ozzy albums that I already had in my library and deleted those. And I didn't actually delete the files, but I deleted my own music off of iTunes Match because I had iCloud Music Library enabled. iTunes Match is part of that, so I could have deleted my own files. The other files were there the whole time, but because of the way that iTunes Match works. Is this making any sense?
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense. Okay. But it's, and I also understand the confusion because Apple changed the behavior. I mean, maybe they explain it somewhere, but they really changed how iTunes Match works. And so I would have been baffled too. But you did say in the headline of the first story, I am through with Apple Music.
Yes.
Are you still through with Apple Music?
I haven't turned it back on yet. No.
Yeah.
No.
Do you think it took unprecedented, and by unprecedented I mean help that no one else would have gotten from Apple to get this sorted out?
I'm not really sure. I mean, it's not like Apple pulled me in and you know, magically recovered all of my files because of...
They didn't give you a special treatment, right?
No.
Yeah.
I you know, there was nothing like that. I mean, those files were there.
They just explained what happened.
Right. And I brought my computer in. I brought a few other devices in. And they went through them and had a look and said, well, here are your files right here. So the files were there. It's just with the way that things changed and how they worked, it wasn't clear to me that they actually were there.
Right.
So if I had one wish for iTunes right now, it would be to put Match back the way that it was so that I could turn on iTunes Match, turn off Apple Music if I wanted to, and turn off iCloud Music Library if I wanted to, because Apple Music needs iCloud Music Library. So if I could do that, I'd be very happy. I think that as a Match subscriber, I pay for iTunes Match, have since it came out. I can open up any device. Until now, I could open up any device and just have iTunes Match, which is just my music,
right,
uploaded, matched, and purchased. That's what I want at this point.
Can you not do that now?
No.
So whether you use Apple Music or not, iTunes Match has changed its behavior.
Right. Right. iTunes Match has changed its behavior regardless of what you do with Apple Music. So you can, if you turn on iCloud Music Library, you can have your old iTunes Match, that behavior. But the problem that I have right now is with Apple Music. So if I turn that on, then Apple Music is part of iCloud Music Library, and I don't want that.
Yeah, you can't turn off Apple Music.
You can't turn off Apple Music. You can turn off the preference to show Apple Music, but it's still going to be in the background. So is there a chance that, you know, in a month or 6 months that I'll use Apple Music again? Sure. I mean, right now, you know, they're coming out with a fix for a lot of the most common problems that we've talked about all over the internet. You know, duplicate songs, and, you know, when you add an album, it wouldn't add songs that you already had in your library somewhere else. That's not right. If I want to add an album, I should be able to add the album. And you can do that now.
There are people out there laughing, saying, well, that's what you get for using iTunes in the first place. I had really hoped that they would rewrite iTunes from scratch with the release of Apple Music. That was not to be. And I think part of the problem is still that they had kind of this legacy system, and they have this new system, and they changed the way the legacy system behaved to make it work with the new system, but they didn't really fully explain. I was always confused about what happens to Match when you do music and all of that. And obviously, somebody like you, who is an accomplished Apple user, was confused. Renee, did they document this very well?
They started documenting it later, which is why, you know, a little bit me, mostly Serenity, had to spend days and days and days writing article after article after article explaining. And iTunes Match, I'm like Jim, I only ever used iTunes Match. And that became renamed to iCloud Music Library, and it got conflated with Apple Music. And it's not so much that the processes changed, but that the way you access them and the naming and all of it became very confused. And the systems, they explained them in very similar ways. And we had that whole issue with what's DRM'd and what's not DRM'd. And a lot of this is just them with a new service figuring out, you know, oh, people are confused by this. How do we fix it? But that's very late. People have been saying, like, you know, like iCloud Photo Library didn't have this problem, that you could just turn it on and it worked. But
I had lots of problems with confusion over iTunes, over photos.
The problem with this that adds to it is that there's no huge commercial photo source that you're trying to commingle your personal problems.
It's just my photos that it screwed up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so for all of these things, I would much prefer that the minute you have someone's critical personal data, Apple decides we're not going to touch that. You are enabling iCloud Music Library or iCloud Photo Library. We're keeping your library locked as is, and everything that we do is going to be almost like a delta file, the way you get when you edit a photo, that it's applied as a filter on top of your stuff. So if you add Apple Music, that's a filter that is in between your music and the ultimate view that's shown in the app. And then whatever you do there, adding music, removing music, anything short of buying music that gets added to your proper library only exists in that silo, and then can never do anything like damaging Jim's Ozzy Osbourne stuff again.
Didn't Apple rush? Do you feel like the problem is that Apple rushed this out?
I don't think.
Well, they've been working on it for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same problem they've had with most of their cloud services, where they don't seem to be able to simply start small and then just simply grow out from a base of features that work and are reliable and people understand them. They really are in a mindset where this doesn't work, so we're going to have to start a new revolution here. And once again, I think that Apple Music reflects that. They didn't decide that we're going to simplify. We're going to turn this into some discrete experiences that everyone's going to be able to understand really, really easily. Instead, it was, we're going to make sure that everything that we already have is still there somewhere in the foundations. They're still sending, you know, roots and tendrils up into the concrete, but we're also going to be pouring brand new concrete. And so there's so much confusion as to what still works, what doesn't work, what is gone, what is new, and what is supposed to work, but you have to turn some things off in order to make it happen.
Yeah, I like the one of the problems, again, is that it has your data behind it. Like, it has Jim's music collection or Leo's photo collection. And if it was just a delta file or just a filter, you could literally just flip a switch and it would be gone and you'd see your old music. And And if you turn it back on, your stuff would be there and there'd never be any damage to your core files. I understand where Apple's coming from with all of this. And it's not like there's a bunch of evil people out there who want to go and destroy your stuff.
No,
they have this idea that they can make, that people are easily confused and they don't have everything in one place and they add Apple Music and it's not in My Music. Then where did that Apple Music go? And it's a series of decisions that when you're stuck in launching a product, you see one way and then the rest of the world hits it, like millions of people, and it makes little sense to them because they haven't been embroiled in those discussions. But at a certain point, all this, to your point, this legacy stuff catches up with you. And iTunes was designed, like, I can't even imagine what iTunes must look like from Apple's point of view now, because it was designed for people to upload music over 10 years ago. And that system has now been scaled to apps, to device management. It has to be ported to Windows. Everyone says, you know, Apple has to rewrite it. And yeah, but it's a billion-dollar business that does billions of dollars in transactions with hundreds of millions of credit cards. And it's non-trivial to scrap that and build something new. Like, they probably are building things in parallel right now and testing them very carefully, but I can't imagine the creaky web objects back end that all this stuff is at least partially still dependent on, and that project could be started fresh, it could be simplified, it could be broken out, but there's all sorts of usability and just simple portability problems that need to be solved, and I think those are going to be really difficult and likely a multi-year project.
Yeah, but the Apple's done difficult things like that before. I mean, they built the Apple Watch. So I really have to believe that this is a solvable problem. It's just a terrible thing that I think the thing that really hurts is knowing that I don't know anybody who trusts iTunes. I don't know anybody who trusts any Apple cloud service right now. And it's not because they're dumb. It's because, man, what fresh hell awaits me as soon as I flip this one switch? As soon as I have, if I have the option between, yes, I want to install that now and maybe later, there is no, can we talk about this later? Because I'm not sure we understand this. I mean, I didn't have any problems with Apple Music, chiefly because I wanted to make sure there was a complete backup of all my music. And not only that, but an air gap between Apple Music and whatever drive that backup was being stored on. That's how little I trusted it.
Yeah.
And I had largely a really good experience with it, but only because with my real music library in safekeeping, I said, well, let's create a brand new iTunes library. Let me approach this as though I'm a brand new user who came home with a Mac for the first time. And it works very, very well. And unfortunately, that underscores a lot of Apple Cloud stuff, where it works great so long as you can start from zero with a vision of music or photos or cloud syncing that matches the way that Apple did it. I think that I would be great if Apple could, if they could build a system where it says no matter how you like to organize your music library, no matter where you like to get your music from, this will support it.
I feel like if you're the company that says so often it just works, there you put yourself in a position where there's a higher expectation.
Yeah, they don't say that anymore. They say we believe now.
Exactly. We've gone from it just works to it mostly just works with
sort of.
We aim to try.
We hope it works. Gosh, we hope it works. No, but you know, I think this is damaging. Right, isn't this damaging to Apple in the long run? People, it never was true that it just worked. Everybody knows that. But Apple somehow had this kind of gilded reputation of really getting stuff done, getting it right.
They survived Mobile Me, Leo.
Yeah. I mean, you can go back and point out product after product where it just didn't work. Nevertheless, there is this their aura around Apple that they get it right. And the more this kind of stuff happens, doesn't it eventually start to tarnish that reputation?
You know, when you look at cloud services, there are a lot of things that developers would like to see, cloud services work better. But as an average user, me, looking at things like calendar, contacts, all this syncing that goes back and forth all of the time, that works flawlessly for me. I've been using it for years. It works great. So here's what I would do. I get a Mac or I get an iPhone or an iPad. I sign in with my Apple ID, bookmarks, calendars, contacts, everything is synced to that device. I turn on iTunes Match. This is before, and all my music is synced.
In the good old days.
within minutes, my device, whatever that device is synced.
I got to point out, though, and Microsoft
works great.
Was late to that party, but does it now. Google does it very well if you use a Chromebook. The Chromebook becomes yours instantly.
Well, maybe we can call that person and
yeah, let's get that person working for Apple. But that is the expectation now because the world has changed a lot. I mean, Apple started in a time when people had a computer, and now they're in a time where people have many devices. And Apple has sold the notion that this ecosystem works best when it's all Apple, and that is the dream what you just described, Jim.
Yeah, I think it's what Andy said before about the ambition of the project, too. I mean, they came out and proudly said, you know, Jimmy Iovine said, we want one consistent thought about music, and that includes radio, and that includes streaming, and that includes Kinect, and you have all this functionality together that, from a certain point of view, makes sense, because why have people run around to different apps to get their music? But when you look at it, for example, I don't have almost any music. Like, when Jim's collection to me is unfathomable. I've just never bought a lot of music. I watch TV mostly, but I can say this. I watch Netflix the way some people listen to radio, so my collection is very different. But Apple Music to me means anytime I want, I can say, hey, Siri, play this, and it just magically starts playing any song I want, anytime I want, more of this. I have almost nothing in my library, and I use Siri almost all the time, and it's nearly miraculous for me. But to cater to my user state and Jim's user state in one product sounds like a nightmare, nigh impossible situation to me. So maybe if you started smaller and you had Apple Music as sort of like a service that doesn't touch whatever traditional service people are using, or again, is that sort of filter on top of it, then you sort of don't set yourself up for these massive personal data problems that you run into.
Well, yeah. And it is no small feat to try and make a service work for all of us. I mean, there are people out there that have monstrous libraries. There are people that I think the people that are enjoying Apple Music the most are the ones that don't have big libraries. You know, I don't consider mine all that big. I mean, but still, through confusion, I think mine would have been okay if things had have worked like I thought that they worked.
I have to think when you see Marco Arment and John Gruber and Jim Dalrymple all complaining that this stuff's not working, that starts to move the train out of the station a little bit.
I think one of the differences is that Apple has never been a company. Apple makes the deal with the user saying that we're going to take a lot of problems off your hands. We're going to solve problems for you. That's the optimal situation for, I would say, more situations than not. But sometimes you would much rather be able to have control over something than have things done for you automatically. Most of the time when I have problems with my iTunes library, I will find out, I will look at my library and feel, oh, okay, that's because once I ripped just three tracks off of this album put the rest away.
That's a self-hating user. You don't blame yourself. You blame the company.
No. I mean, you can take a look. No, that's not self-hating. It's about taking a look at here's what just happened here. Okay,
it's
I accidentally
fault.
Put two copies of this thing.
I'm not using it right.
Because sometimes it is my fault.
Never your fault.
I would like that in writing. I'd like an affidavit to that effect because I could make great use of that statement. But what I'm saying is that the most frustrating thing isn't a situation in which you screwed yourself up. It's a situation in which, wow, I had 6,000 pieces of music in my library. Now I have 8. I don't know where they went. And after 45 minutes of looking at things, I have no idea where they went or how to get them back.
Well, now there is a drumbeat. Ben Lovejoy writing in 9 to 5 Mac. iTunes is now so clunky, the only safe solution is to nuke it from orbit. Marco Arment saying if Apple had only done with iTunes what they did with photos, they would have a decent product. And Gruber saying exacto mundo. When are we going to get a new iTunes? I think the world has agreed. Now it's too late, right? Now you've got legacy music now in there, and now you're really screwed. You should have done it now. This was the time. They waited a long time after buying Beats before putting out Apple Music.
Well, that was probably a really big thing to try and put together, though. I don't know if they could have done a new iTunes in time for an Apple Music launch. I mean, Rennie explained it earlier. It's huge. It's a huge job. But,
it's dependencies. It's laden with dependencies.
Well, it's not getting better. Now it's got more dependencies.
Yes.
It's going to only, it's basically, It's like Jimmy Hoffa. You're now encased in cement.
So the interesting thing about like if you look at Marco's article, you look at John's Exactamundo, or you look at some of the other articles, they are both absolutely right and non-helpful at the same time. So like from our perspective, from a user perspective, Apple just needs to fix this. Like everyone says, it's Apple's job to fix this. It behooves us to understand the size of the problem so we can set our expectations for timelines and things like that. But at the bottom line, Apple absolutely has to fix this. If iTunes is unworkable for not only a majority of users, but for core users who have been using it for years, that is a huge problem that needs to be solved. Understanding the technical and commercial debt of iTunes can make us say, well, they can fix this in a year, they can fix this in 2 years, in 3 years, and maybe they've already been spending that time doing it and we just haven't seen it. There have been rumors that there was a new music app that was supposed to launch with Apple Music, but for some reason it didn't work out and they had to put everything back into iTunes. And maybe
that's interesting.
Maybe that's true, maybe that's not, but usually there are these projects working along. Like Photos, they announced that at WWC. It came out for Mac earlier on this year, I think some 6 or 8 months later, and it's going to be iterated again in El Capitan. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see a lot of that happening. But the big problem that they have to solve is that iTunes lives on incredibly creaky old infrastructure. Things like web objects, things like the iTunes backend, which podcasters, if you've got podcast access, you've seen the best version possible of that. Not all of it's that nice. And they have to move all that to modern web infrastructure. And maybe they have to move iTunes to the cloud. The way iWork is on the cloud now, iTunes can be on the cloud. Then you can drop PC compatibility so you don't have to port everything, bundle it up, make it run on Windows, and have just a bunch of separate Mac clients the way you do on iOS. But all of those pieces have to be built together. All the DRM for videos that they still sell that are bundled up in FairPlay. All of that, like device management, device sync, all of that has to be rationally thought out with as many edge use cases as possible and then rolled out into the operating system. And that is a huge task, and I wouldn't be surprised if that is a multi-year.
I'll tell you what the problem is, and it is a deep-rooted problem, and it's a problem of hubris, that Apple, in its desire to continue to grow at this rapid pace, wants to own the entire ecosystem from A to Z, or A to Z in your case. and even Microsoft doesn't do that anymore. Even, you know, this is nuts. And
to be fair,
they're biting off more than they can chew in their greed. And I'm sorry, they're gonna screw the pooch. Go ahead.
I don't think that's true. I mean, to be fair, Microsoft doesn't have the ability to control the ecosystem. So they have to adapt to the world that they're
in. Apple didn't used to. But now Apple says, oh, we're big enough. We're going to do the whole damn thing. And they do a crap job.
Well, it's not a crap job, but they...
come on.
Remember, they have a consistent philosophy, which is that, again, you buy an Apple product, we will try to take care of as many of your problems as we possibly can. Trust us, we'll make everything work together. And by and large, they do. It's just that when they drop the ball, that same philosophy makes it very, very difficult for a user to feel as though they have control to solve the problem. Specifically for music, they don't have this problem with Photos. Because they've never really tried to solve that problem in a comprehensive way. Even if the new version of Photos isn't suitable for your use, there are all kinds of third-party apps, including Lightroom, including professional apps, that will let you take control of your photo library and organize it the way that you want. There is no concurrent solution for music. Really, if you want to organize a music library and have it useful to other apps, you have to use iTunes. And if iTunes is borked, your entire music experience is borked, which is why I would love to see Apple do this. I'm not even the 100th person to posit this, but it would be great if Apple simply broke out the library on-device library management as a separate app or as a separate experience and had the ability to keep tweaking that and improving that as it goes, and also creating new opportunities for third parties to create replacements for that app, so that once you'll have an app that's optimized for people who just buy things off the iTunes store or are satisfied with Spotify or Apple streaming music, but also apps that are that will satisfy people who have 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 tracks on there.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, Apple increases its revenue 38% and loses $60 billion on the stock market. I don't understand. We'll have to figure this all out. High Finance 101 coming up in just a second. I'm really thrilled to have Jim Dalrymple, editor-in-chief of loopinsight.com here. It's great to have you, Jim.
Always like being here.
You've never been here.
I have. Well, I've been on Twit before.
Yeah, but never on MacBreak Weekly, which is a horrific oversight on our part.
I thought that you had something against me.
I don't. I think the world of you.
It's like when you know that Tom Cruise is in town and you want to invite them to your graduation party, but you figure he already has plans for Tuesday night.
It's exactly that. Andy and I go here also.
Jim, what we're telling you is that we're going to be really annoying now. Every time there isn't even a hint that someone's not going to be available, you're going to be one of the first calls.
We're right away.
I'll be here.
Good. Dealio. Also, Renee Ritchie from iMore.com. Our show today brought to you by JustWorks.com. Running a successful business, you can take it for any, is hard enough. And the thousands of little details really can make it feel overwhelming. Plus, nobody really starts a business to deal with paperwork. It's one of the reasons, I think JustWorks is a great idea. It helps businesses take care of the stuff you don't want to take care of. It's not your core competency. Benefits, payroll, HR. With JustWorks, you're equipped to take care of your team and focus on what you do. JustWorks processes your payroll automatically, sets up your team's benefits online, helps you save on healthcare because you're part of a bigger group. It's just that simple. And by the way, JustWorks is very computer literate. They have great software, so you can automate payroll and compliance. You can grow your business, not your busy work. Just take you a couple of minutes. The average setup time, 3 minutes. JustWorks.com. Many of the companies we like to talk about, like Casper and Imprint and Reboot and hundreds more, the hippest, best startups out there are using JustWorks.com. If you're in business, do the business that matters, the stuff you care about. Let JustWorks handle the rest. Go to JustWorks.com and request a demo or even sign up today. Find out how you can offer your team the benefits they want at prices you can afford. Go to JustWorks.com, enter the offer code MacBreak at checkout. You'll get 15% off the first year of service. What? 15% off your first year of services. That's a good one. That's great. JustWorks.com. Don't forget to use that offer code MacBreak. And we're so glad to have them as part of our family on MacBreak Weekly. I just love the stock market. Apple has a record profit, 38% profit growth, robust growth in China, sales double, cash reserves break $200 billion. They sold 35% more iPhones year over year. And of course, the third quarter is the slow quarter because everybody knows a new iPhone's coming. And the stock market punishes them to the tune of $60 billion in market cap.
Yeah. Stock market's stupid. They're very near-term focused, and they read an article that's sensationalized or says Apple is doomed and immediately start shorting shares because they think other people will. It's right. It's almost like casino mob mentality.
Yeah, so let's ignore the stock market. I just think it's a strange and funny thing, 5.2% drop.
I don't think that any company that reports a profit of $10 billion should ever be worried about the stock market hitting them like that. It's wrong. And these expectations that that the market goes down on, the expectation of analysts, they're just pulling them out of their butt. I mean, they have these complex math equations that they want to use to say where Apple should be, but $10 billion, profit.
I think it's worse than that. I think there's actual manipulation going on. And it's hard to say that, but like they present an article, MarketWatch posts an article saying the Apple Watch sales have tanked 90%, and they show data that they don't contextualize. And then Tim Cook comes out and says, well, actually, we're selling more than ever and way more than that data suggests. But that's already cost them $4 billion in stock valuation.
They're coming back, but it's up and down. I'm just looking at the 1 month. They're at $123.77 a share. Of course, the low after the results came out was that 120?
The fractal pattern says if you just stay the course, you end up making money over time.
I mean, look, at the stock market, this is not a business podcast. We're not covering business even. I personally don't care how much money Apple makes. I'm more interested in, does Apple make a product you should use how to use it better? That's what we care about. But I have to say, this is just kind of stunning. Does it matter, though, what the market cap is? Does that affect how Apple does business?
No.
Not really. No,
it doesn't. I mean, Apple has made clear over the years that they have a way that they think about business and a way that they think about putting out products and stores and everything else. And they hold the line. That's the way that they continue to do things. So as long as they stay focused on the product and how the product affects its users, then they'll continue to be successful. If they start throwing, you know, hundreds of products on the market like Samsung does just to try and see if they can increase sales, then that's a time to start to worry. But otherwise, they, if as long as, you know, Johnny Ive and Tim and Phil Schiller and Eddie Q and all of these the top execs keep everybody focused on what's important, they'll be good.
That's the hard part, isn't it? Because then you go to the shareholders meeting and the shareholders yell at you if the stock price has gone down, and you get people like Carl Icahn making destructive suggestions about how you should run the company in order to keep the stock price up. I'm sure that's why Apple's doing a buyback, and I guess the lower price is good for the Apple buyback. They're doing fine. Look at this chart. They're doing fine on cash. And to me, that makes a difference to Apple. That means they can acquire, they can invest in R&D.
It's firepower. Yeah,
it's firepower. They do you have this chart? There it is. Apple, $202 billion, almost $203 billion in cash. GE, $131. Microsoft, $96. Google, $69. Apple, IBM, $8. That's impressive.
Yeah.
Partly, though, that's because Apple never does anything with that money.
Well, it shows that doing things with your money hasn't always been profitable when you look at things like the Nokia write-down. You know, maybe they'd be better off keeping that cash.
$7.6 billion Microsoft had to write off after buying Nokia? Trying basically to buy its way into this business that Apple's doing so well in, the iPhone business.
That's exactly right. And there's a big difference between being able to build yourself into that business and trying to buy into it.
Yeah.
I mean, Nokia, remember back, Leo, those little Nokia
phones.
They were
dominant.
Well, it was huge. And then all of a sudden, you know, BlackBerry came and some of the other makers came before 2007 when the iPhone was released. But before that, Nokia, man, they were great.
Google sold Motorola as well. It's not easy.
Yeah, Motorola used to be the dominant smartphone, not smartphone, cell phone company.
That also points to why you can be so enthusiastic about Apple's future. I think there might be a point at which whatever secret sauce that consumers perceive in the iPhone might disappear. It's something you might worry about when you start to see exactly how much money Apple here's the graph of how much money Apple makes off of the iPhone, and then here's how much money they make off of everything else. And you start to worry, well, what if they get Nokia out of the way or BlackBerry out of the way of that? Number one, because Apple keeps trying to move the iPhone forward and they're the only supplier, that's unlikely to happen. But also they have all these other businesses that they're going to be cultivating. And part of the reasons why they're free to cultivate that is because they do have enough cash reserves to experiment and have many, many, many private failures that they never have to acknowledge, never have to own up to, but will help to teach that will prevent them from having to make a failed product that diverts their resources and their focus.
There also is a point where you get to lock in that people buy iPhones because everybody else is buying iPhone. You know, you get this kind of momentum that is just unstoppable.
A network effect.
Yeah,
yeah. There's definitely a degree to which the Apple logo is a product in and of itself, and if you were to put some of their products, not all their products, but some of them side by side, and you think, well, why are people spending so much money on the Apple one and they're not buying this one instead? And you have to figure that the Apple logo is at least a factor, at least in certain markets, particularly in China. But they're clearly not they're not selling themselves entirely as a fashion brand, because that would be absolute disaster.
Well, fashion might not be the right word. I mean, technology, people have always bought technology.
Based on what
other people are doing. I mean, Windows sold well forever and continues to sell well in the home, where you could argue it shouldn't be, because that's what people saw at work. And they go, well, okay, there's this kind of herd mentality.
That's a little bit different, because there are still people that, you know, when you talk about what is the budget price for a decent laptop, and for a lot of people, $900 is not the definition of a budget laptop.
I get that call on the radio show all the time. They say, but I can buy a Windows laptop for $500 or $200.
Right.
Why should I buy a Mac?
The $200 one is kind of crap, but it's okay if you want something for your kids to use. But you can actually buy a really high-quality Windows notebook for $600, $700 will get you a very high-quality one. Once you start spending $900, you are almost in the premium range of Windows content. So it's not just that. I think, as I've said before, I always say that Microsoft, you know, they are the gears and the grease of industry, where they have the responsibility, self-absorbed responsibility, to sell computers to 90% of the people who need a computer, whereas Apple has aligned themselves to say that we will allow you to have 90% of the market. We will take the 6% or the 8% of the market that will spend a 40% markup on an actually premium device or something that has the perception of a premium device. And so that's the difference between sitting on top of $210 billion and sitting on top of $70 million.
But there is still the concern that most of your profit, like 90%, comes from one product. You have to diversify.
It's a good problem to have, though, Leo.
I'd love that.
And they have a lot of time to figure it out.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely some runway there. They've got $203 billion in the bank. You know, they could go out and buy the movie industry and just say, well, we'll just do this for now. I mean, they could. There's all sorts of things you can do with that kind of money. Little concern about iPad sales. And this was, again, down 13% decline over the previous quarter. Year over year, 19% decline. Sales are for the iPad are slowing. You see those spikes. That's, of course, when new iPads are announced in Q1.
I don't think that we've seen the upgrade cycle yet for iPad. If you look at iPhones, people are willing to trade an iPhone in, pay extra to get the new iPhone, to get out of their current one. But for the iPad, I think it's more along the lines of a computer upgrade. You know, you're willing to keep a computer for several years before you upgrade. And that, I think, is what's going on here. I'm still not concerned about iPad sales because I still think that we're in a situation where, you know, in the next year or so, we're going to start to see some churn in sales and people upgrading.
What will stimulate that? Is it a newer, better product, or is it the death of the old iPad? What is going to make people upgrade?
Well, certainly it's going to be the death of older devices.
The battery doesn't work anymore.
Right. You know, there's going to be little things like that. The new features in the OS and certainly the hardware itself, where it allows people to do more and more. And we're starting to see that already, where new OS versions and new hardware allow people to do more. And people want to do more. Now, there are a lot of people out there, older people and younger people, who will just use an iPad for internet, for, you know, email and web surfing. And for those ones, the older iPads are just fine. But, you know, we're still seeing iPad sales, I think, because people like me and you and Rennie and Andy who want to do a little bit more and will go out and get that. But at some point, you know, even with the oldest iPad or the oldest computer, you're going to do an upgrade. And I think that when that churn starts, then we're going to see things pop a bit.
Do people still use their iPads, right? I mean, that's actually, to me, that would be the metric. Not how what sales are like, but you see people using their iPads.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see what effect iOS 9 and if Apple does come up with an iPad Pro comes along. Because, again, 90% of the close to 90% of the people out there are not Mac users. They're Windows users. And they're going to a store with $500 or $600 in their hands. They may not see the reason to walk out with a 9.7-inch one app at a time, one window at a time, really honking, huge book reader-looking sort of device. But it's going to be interesting when Apple has iOS 9, where they have interfaces that have been on part of Windows since Windows 8 that make it really, really efficient to be truly productive with multiple apps on this small screen at the same time. Apple will finally have a really credible answer to the question, I've got $500 or $600. I want to buy a laptop that doesn't have to do everything, but it has to do do the basics and do them well. What do you got for me? And Apple has never had an answer to that question. But once they have the ability to simply demonstrate, here's how you run multiple apps at the same time, and here's how you can be on one app and still be watching a video in the corner of the screen at the same time, I think that's going to siphon off a lot of the people who otherwise would be spending that money on a very nice Asus Windows laptop or Windows convertible.
On my vacation, I saw a lot of I was surprised to see a lot of Android tablets. I saw quite a few iPads, and by the way, much older crowd. Okay, so It's a riverboat cruise, so the average age is in the 70s.
A lot of these people, they get there. A lot of cable companies are actually giving away laptops with that. So that's where a lot of those things.
There's one thing that Jim said that I think is really interesting there, though. And Tim Cook, I believe, on the earnings call said that we haven't seen the iPad upgrade cycle yet, or at least Apple hasn't seen it.
They just didn't know what it was. It's a new product. They don't know what it's going to be. No, same thing with the watch.
But when you look at the iPhone, people upgrade for specific reasons. Like a lot of people upgrade because they want a better camera, because the iPhone literally is the camera they have with them. Or they see something like you can play games. There's a lot of reasons why they've seen people specifically upgrade an iPhone. But when you look at the iPad, it's been sold to a lot of people for whom traditional computers are inaccessible or intimidating.
Those people otherwise in their 70s.
Yeah, and they don't – like if there's a laminated screen on the iPad Air 2, it's meaningless to them. Yeah. So there's no point in upgrading, but they'll come to a point where that iPad 2 is just too sluggish, or the battery dies, or something else happens, and they love the iPad, so they're going to want to get it. And yes, there will be people who use it as a laptop alternative, and it'll be even better for them. But there'll be all these people who will they'll never open Slide Over, or they'll never open Split View. It'll just be another really simple, awesome computer that is exactly what they need for their computing, and they'll buy the next one. And maybe it's a 3-year cycle, 4-year cycle. Apple makes these things pretty well. I've got iPad 2s. Relatives are still using them wonderfully today. Maybe not next year, maybe not the year after, and they'll have to buy something new. But until we start seeing that, like you said, Leo, it's a new product. We have no idea what the cycle is.
Yeah.
And realize that does go both ways too. Apple sold gangbusters 9.7-inch iPads when all they had in the world were 9.7-inch iPads to sell.
Right.
When there were no when there were no color Kindles, there were no large size phone tablets. I really wish we could see more numbers. I really wish Apple could break down what models sell in which proportions, because I certainly see fewer 9.7-inch iPads in the field as I do iPad minis. And I also know from other market research that a lot of people who might have gone for an iPad mini or even a full-sized iPad are now saying, well, gee, now I've got a 5.8-inch, 5.9-inch phone. All I wanted was a slightly larger screen so that I could read cool stuff on the bus or on the subway in the morning. And this big phone seems to address that for me quite adequately. So we really don't know one way or another. It's possible that we're going to see a huge churn of people coming in who bought iPads 3 years ago. And as soon as they see a new iPad with that one magic new feature they're waiting for, everyone rushes in to buy the new one. Or we could see just as legitimately proof that 9.7 inches was never an ideal size. It was never the size that consumers wanted. It was just the size that was available. And that that's what built the success of the iPad. We just don't know.
I don't think that that's it. I think that there were other sizes available, but I think that was the optimum size for the technology that Apple wanted to put in it at the time. And, you know, I mean, Steve famously said that he didn't want to do a smaller iPad, but he did. And I think a lot of that has to do with the technology that's available and what the market shows after you release a product. And you have to be willing to make changes like that. And it's good that they are. It's good that they're not sticking to, no, we said we'd never do this. Well, times change.
Two rumors I like, and I hope that they come true in October, are a Pro, as you mentioned, with a multi-touch.
Force touch.
What do you call it? Not just force touch, but also touch sensitive. What do you call it?
Yeah, they call that force touch, too. It's all conflated.
It's all force touch. Yeah. Okay. The ability to draw, press harder or lighter and have different widths of drawing. I don't know what you call it. There's got to be a word. And then I'm liking this new rumor I just saw this week. I don't know. Tell me if it's credible. Give me a yep or a nope. On a new iPad mini, which I always liked the mini, but along the lines of an iPad Air 2, same kind of form factor, a smaller screen, obviously, same maybe A8, maybe even A9 processor. In other words, a high power little one as well as a high power big one. Credible?
I think that as Apple continues to upgrade these, they're going to put more power into these machines. They have to, because people are using iPads, you know, the iPad mini for gaming. I mean, they just put support for metal in the iPod Touch.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? Yeah.
You know, it makes perfect sense.
But high-powered mini would be, as a gaming device, would be awesome.
Last year, Leo. Last year, it got the year before specs. So if this year it gets the year before specs,
so it'd get the A8, not the A9.
Yeah. And that's the worst.
Will there be an Air 3?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Why not? Also, realize why not? I don't even know why it's an it might be an advantage for Apple to even have a CPU difference between the Mini and the and the and the 9.7.
They can't make enough.
Why have it a year old?
They couldn't make, like last year the best story I heard is that they couldn't make enough. There simply wasn't enough yield on the Apple A8 processor to get it in. The iPhone was massive. They had to put almost all of them into the iPhone, and then they had to make the A8X for the iPad too. And there just simply wasn't enough capacity to make it for an iPad Mini. Right.
That makes sense.
Which is why it took until now to put it in.
Pressure sensitive is the term I was looking for. A pressure sensitive Pro. Yeah. And by the way, that's unique and might be enough, I think, the reason to try these things to drive people back to the market. I've got
it's
a regular Air 2.
Ooh,
but I'd like Force Touch. I'd like pressure sensitivity. I'd like a bigger screen. I'd like a
And
stylus.
Unlike Wacom, it doesn't need an intermediary layer between the screen and the digitizer.
Technology's
so
much
it's good technology. Okay,
so it's better than a Cintiq.
Yes. Well, it's better technology. However, they implement it remains to be seen. But theoretically, technology is better.
Realize that Wacom has created a system that has revolutionized digital illustration. Everybody has that technology in their studios. Even people who are just doing little web comics that they're not really doing that they're not making a whole lot of money off of.
Cintiq is the monitor with Wacom pressure sensitivity.
Yeah, I mean, Apple would really have to make sure that they're creating a product that they can't they don't have, they're not going to be in a position of convincing artists that no, you don't want that, you want this.
Right.
They really are going to have to listen to make sure that they give them a tool. I mean, people there are entire blogs about pencils. That's how fiddly people are about their creative tools.
I know you know a lot of comic illustrators. Yeah. But some are using Surface, right? Microsoft
Surface took off. Even Surface One took off gangbusters because they were giving them not Wacom technology, but similar enough to Wacom technology and a couple of different apps that made it work with that they could just simply be in an airport lounge and actually do real work for it. So that's another quite big asset. I'm more concerned about if Apple puts Force. I don't think that Apple has really implemented Force Touch well on the watch yet. I've been wearing this for 2 months. I still don't instinctively know here's what it means when I force touch something versus here's what it means when I long press something. And I think that Apple really needs to get that vocabulary down cold before they start to complicate it by making it expand across the surface of even an iPhone.
I turn it off on my MacBook because I don't know what the hell's going on.
I love it on
the MacBook.
Do you?
Yeah.
You need to train me.
Force touch on the watch, though, is a lot about exploration. I mean, you go into an app, and when I started to first realize that, oh, I can force touch things here, I was going into apps of all kinds and just, force touching on the screen
and
finding out what it did. Yeah, it's kind of like that.
Discoverability through play.
If there's something like in notifications, and there's an easy way to get rid of a notification, you just swipe from right to left, and a box comes up, and you can clear it. If you force touch, it just says clear all. I mean, I didn't know that right off, but through trial and error, I found all of these different things, and it wasn't difficult to find. You just press on the screen. So the way that they describe things, yes, maybe that can be cleared up, but I think that they did a good job of implementation. And really, that's what's important, because I found most of the stuff using it on my own, not by reading documentation that Apple released.
I can only speak to my own experience, and it's that I also, you have this great thing about Apple products that you have this sense of play about it, that you don't just want to, please give me the one feature that I wanted. Okay, great, you give me the result I wanted, and I'm done with you. You really do want to push all the buttons and twirl all the knobs and figure out what things happen. The problem is that it's still 2 months later, and I do not instinctively know, like if I'm in a brand new app, what does a force touch mean versus a long press? And there's still times when I'm assuming, even with notifications and things like that, of course, I found out that you force touch and you can do a clear all on a list of notifications. But there's still so many times where I think that, okay, I'm using the pedometer app. I want to take a look at number of steps versus something like something else. Okay, do I tap? No. Okay, do I swipe? No, that doesn't do it. Do I force touch? No, force touch does nothing. I still don't know. I feel as though right now I should know instinctively what force touch implies in a user interface. I would, for instance, the first thing I would have put on the whiteboard is that taps are for manipulating the information that you see. Force touch is to get at settings or get at ways of manipulating the app itself. Just as an example, if that were something that were to carry through from app to app to app to app, it would be something that I know the vocabulary about this. I know what this verb means. right now it's something that I screw around with eventually after messing with with a watch app. And if I can remember what it does in this one app, that will be very, very useful, like clearing all notifications. Otherwise, it's something that if there's a way to not use it, I probably won't discover it and I probably won't.
But isn't that kind of like trying to dictate what a preference window does in a Mac app? You know, you can't dictate where companies put things or how they use it, but you can put the window there. So Apple makes Force Touch available to apps. What they choose to implement under the Force Touch is up to the developer. I mean, if a developer is doing something really weird in Force Touch, can't you write and say, look, you know, that's not really what Force Touch is for. Shouldn't you use it for this instead and let them figure it out?
Yeah. To me, it feels more like a right click, or it feels more like a hold down the command key while you're selecting something. It doesn't feel like here's a window. You can do whatever you want with it. I could be wrong about that, but that's just, again, what it feels to me like when I think about Force Touch. I would love to see that there's some sort of a consistency about what I can expect when I Force Touch on something versus long press something.
There's two things that I thought was really interesting is that one is that I have this ongoing debate with designers about whether Fitz's law for multi-touch is force press, that inevitably you'll get angry or excited enough about your screen that you'll force press it and you'll discover things, because that's the ultimate extent of it's like throwing the mouse pointer at the corner. But the problem here is that I don't think there really should be long press on the watch, and there is in things like the color selector on the palettes, and that could easily be force touch anyway. I understand why it's not, because it's a different mechanic, but you force press and long press can't really coexist, because any force press is by definition a long press. So it would just simplify things if they were all, you know, force press, and that's another argument. But my mom did a review for the Apple Watch on Friday, and it was fascinating.
Is that on iMore?
Yeah, it was on iMore on Friday, and it's amazing because she's like the third or fourth person I've interviewed who's just not a techie person and just loves the Apple Watch. And all of the things that drive us crazy, they don't even notice. Like, I don't know if she does force press. I know she doesn't use Control Center or Notification Center. She loves that it makes her stand, like it encourages her to stand up, and she loves that she can make the walking goals, all the stuff Jim has written about previously. And she loves that she gets notifications and phone calls because her watch is almost always in her purse or charging, and she kept missing those if my sister or I would try to call her or text her. So it does several things so well for her that even it's become a necessary part of her experience, but a very simple one. She doesn't need all these different nuances. It's just those basic things are great for her. And I wonder if in these discussions about like very minute interface things, we're missing a larger audience that just wants a couple jobs done.
Yeah, I still think that I had a first impression back in September that I was prepared to modify as you get more experience, that I do think that there may be too many control surfaces or maybe too many mechanical or more interfaces than are actually required. Maybe this will change once we see more third-party developers actually make real apps for it. But not only force, I think I could get along very well without force press at all. But the other thing is that I almost never use the digital crown as anything other than a clicky button. If I need to scroll something. Exactly. If I need to scroll, my instinct is still scroll this way. And I can't think off the top of my head of any single interface where my instinct is, oh, I want to adjust that. I will do one of these instead. So maybe that's, again, maybe people will figure out better ways to use it, or there'll be those killer apps that figure out what the verb is on that. But
well, it's one of those things like they're changing the complications where you have to spin the selector is the only time I find it really valuable, because it's really hard to do a tiny little selector, like changing the complication on your watch. I think that's the use case for it. Yeah.
Remember when John Casasanta and Tap 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 came out that allows you to take a picture using the volume button? Yeah. You know, that was huge. People loved that. And then Apple finally adopted that as well. But when they first did that, it was such a great use of the button because it just made sense. And, you know, further to Andy's point, I think that people will come up with other uses for the digital crown, because I'm the same way. What I have to scroll through is usually a very short list. Now, I have gone into mail, and this was during the testing when I was looking at it, and it made much more sense to scroll using the crown because it was so quick. But I don't often go into mail on my phone. You know, I usually just look at the notifications. There's four or five or six there, and, you know, a flick with the finger will get me through them.
Yeah, it's going to be really cool to see iOS to see Watch OS 2.0, because right now I think we're really only getting about 60% of what the watch actually is, which is why I'm always a little bit cautious when I say something, when I state an opinion that's based on what I feel is an unfinished product right now. For instance, there's a lot of stuff that I know that there's a watch app for it, but I've used that watch app 2 or 3 times, and now my instinct is I'll just reach into my pocket and do this on the phone, because I know it'll be much more pleasant, it'll be much faster, and there'll be no delay in communicating between these two devices. So we're only seeing. I'm so happy that I've had the same experiences that Renee has had. That I have an Evernote notebook full of observations about what the Andy Anatko experience has been with the Apple Watch, but I have to counterbalance that with people who are not necessarily techie people. They bought it because they thought it was a cool watch, and it seems as though they have the ability to use as much of it as they want and stay out of the deep end of the pool if that end of the pool scares them, or if they're not adventurous enough to go find it.
I think it's the first product I could think of that Apple's done that doesn't have a universal audience, a potentially universal audience. Some people like it.
Well, some people don't have a use for it.
It's got a lot of dependencies right now, which most of their other products haven't. Like, you could just buy an iPhone, you could just buy an iPad.
True.
The Apple Watch, you have to have an iPhone 5 or an iPhone 6 class product.
I think there's people like your mom who love it, and there's people like me who, I mean, I see the value of it. I wore it a lot, but it's like, it just doesn't knock me out.
It really helped me because, with Apple Watch and HealthKit, I've lost 45 pounds.
Well, that's awesome. Now.
And I would not have done that if it wasn't for HealthKit and Apple Watch, because it's information. You know, information, we've said before, information is knowledge and knowledge is power. Well, this gave me the information that I needed on how my body reacts to food and how it reacts to exercise and what I can do and what I can't do, or more what I should do. I still, I'm not fanatical about a diet or anything, but I do try and fill the rings on my watch. I try and make sure that I'm eating a bit healthier these days. But regardless of what I do in the run of a day, it's going to give me feedback on how I've done. The next morning, if I've gained 10 pounds, then I shouldn't eat those 4 pizzas and dozen
four?
Beer.
Really?
You know? But if I've lost, a half a pound or a pound or whatever it is from the day before, I can look and say, okay, well, I walked for 3 miles yesterday. I ate good. I did this. And it's always there. It's always telling me something.
Well, not to diminish your experience, because that's fantastic, but that's what we hear about the Apple Watch, is a lot of these individual anecdotes about how great it was for me for this or this, but it's not a universal experience. I mean, it's just some people really dig it, like your mom or like Jim, and some people don't.
That's fine.
That's fine. Nothing wrong with that. It just seems unique in the Apple sphere.
You know, one of the themes that might be underlying this show is that Apple sometimes is a victim of its people's own high expectations.
Absolutely.
Of it.
Absolutely.
If there isn't an Apple Watch on every single wrist, then it's not a failure, but it's not as big a success as it could be. It's not the cultural phenomenon of introducing a iMac with several colorful colors on it, and now George Foreman grills are now aping that industrial design. that was a fluke. That was a wonderful fluke. But it's helping a lot of people and giving them a lot of pleasure and a lot of joy, and that's good enough. And it's also an opportunity to extend the conversation. That I'm taking a wider look into fitness bands, and now my band du jour is the Garmin VivoSmart, where it's not as good as an Apple Watch, but it's $120. It will also have notifications on your wrist. It will also track your steps. It will also tell you, hey, you've been sitting too long. Get up and walk around, and I'll tell you when it's okay to sit back down again. And it's more approachable to a great number of people. Just like Jim said, when you have numbers in front of you, it's a lot easier to figure out where your problems are and what you need to address and what you need to fix. I do think that the watch telling me, I was driving two days ago, and I had to say, really, watch, you're telling me to stop the car, get out of the car, and walk for to get, you can't figure out that I'm driving right now. But nonetheless, it's great to have that data about here is the days you were active and not active. Even if it's just through your phone, even if you're just going to that little pane on Google services that lets you take a look at all the data that's collected on you, and you can see here are the days that you were very, very active. Here's the days that you left the house. Here's 2 days in a row you did not leave the house. Is there something maybe you want to check out why you didn't leave the house for 2 days last week? It's all data and it's all helpful.
Coming up, movie time. We're going to watch some flicks. Stay right here. Our show today, well, we're having fun, by the way. Great panel. Andy Iannocco, Chicago Sun-Times, Renee Ritchie, iMore.com. And joining us, and I hope it'll happen more often now, the editor-in-chief of Loop Insight. You may remember him from many years at Macworld and Mac Central. Jim Dalrymple is here. The man who created the term YEP.
The beard.
The beard. I didn't realize you'd lost that much weight, Jimmy. That's fantastic. Congratulations.
Yeah, it's been quite a year.
Good for you. Nice.
Means buying all kinds of new clothes, though. I was wearing a 38 pant, and now I'm down to 34, and even those are getting too big.
Nice.
So.
Boy, that does feel good.
Like our friend Guy English said, who would have believed that he would go to Jim Dalrymple for health advice?
I think there's still some Heineken and pizza in him somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
Our show today brought to you by LegalZoom. You don't, there's so many things that you need to do legal documents for, but you don't need to go to a lawyer for. And LegalZoom fills that gap so that you can get the things you need done for your business, for your life, without spending a huge amount of money on a lawyer. This is National Make-A-Will Month, you know. Do you want the government to decide what happens to your property and your little kids? If not, this is it. Time to protect your family. Make that commitment with a last will or a living trust today. It's easier than you'd think. And, you know, when we did it, they send you this great kit. They make it so fun. You actually kind of get into it. They've created a better way for you and your spouse to take control of your family's future. Check out LegalZoom's new Last Will and Living Trust bundles. The more you plan ahead with wills, with trusts, with powers of attorney, not only the more you save, but the better you feel. This is the month to do it. LegalZoom's online resources and estate planning tools help you figure out what you need so you won't be confused by the many options they can provide for you. Check the lists, and they'll send you the kit. And this is relatively new at LegalZoom. You can get specific guidance from LegalZoom's network of independent attorneys in most states. LegalZoom's not a law firm, but they can connect you with an independent attorney at a pre-negotiated low flat rate. It's just great. Look, this is not the kind of thing you should put off. I know nobody wants to think about it, but you got to protect your family. Get legal help you can count on at LegalZoom.com today. National Make-A-Will Month. And don't forget to enter MBW in the referral box when you check out. You'll save a little bit. LegalZoom.com, offer code MBW. We thank them so much for their support. And even if just, 1% of you go out and make a will that you didn't have before, I'll feel like we've done our job. LegalZoom.com. Do it for your family. You have the trailer on iMore.com. The guy who did, Alex Gibney, he did Secrets, a Story of WikiLeaks, has made a new documentary which showed at the South by Southwest Festival this year. Eddie Q called it inaccurate and mean-spirited. It's my kind of documentary. It's coming out in the theaters September 4th, the first trailer. Would you like to watch the first trailer of Steve Jobs, The Man in the Machine? A trailer approved for all audiences. No, appropriate audiences. Whatever that is.
Thank you for coming. We're going to make some history together today.
Steve Jobs had one speed, full on.
I saw my first computer when I was 12. I was so fascinated by this.
Time magazine says single-handedly he created the industry.
Working in this garage, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak built the first Apple computer board.
It was the magic. We could influence the world.
Hello, I am Macintosh.
He wanted to have a foot in both worlds. He wanted to be the renegade, but he also wanted to be legit.
This is a 21st century bicycle.
He was on a mission.
Can we help you express yourself in richer ways?
He made the iMac.
Can you see it?
He made the iPod. He made the iPhone.
Isn't this awesome?
He's made everything.
His stuff was beloved, but it wasn't that he was beloved.
He was paid $7,000. He told me we were paid $700 and wrote me a check for $350. And that hurts because we were friends.
Steve did create reality distortion around him.
He could convince people to do something they thought was impossible.
The work was intense. The commitment needed to do it was intense. I lost my wife. I lost my children.
He says, if you choose to leave my family, I will personally take you down.
This is a story that's amazing. It's got theft, stolen property, extortion, there's sex in there.
He knows he's the father.
Somebody should make a movie out of this.
Creativity is a lot about anarchy.
He was a study in contrast. Beautiful, haunting, brilliant.
He was not that much fun most of the time. But there are those moments when suddenly he's the only person who could ever done it.
The minute that you understand that you can poke life, that you can change it, you can mold it, you'll never be the same again.
What makes you want to see it?
What would you say about the responsibilities of power?
Power? What is that?
What do you think? Have you seen it? Anybody seen it?
No, it premiered at South by Southwest, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. I like the trailer only because when we've seen too many Steve Jobs projects that seem to want to make him out of marble and reduce him to an archetype as opposed to a human being. We're all familiar both with stories we've read, stories we've been told by people that we can share, and stories we've been told by people that we can't share, that Steve was a very complex individual, but that's definition of a human being. So if the hagiography has been put aside to say, let's have an honest talk about all the things that made him great and all these things that made him somewhat less than ideal person to work with, I think that's a very, very positive thing for history.
Jim or Renee, have you seen it?
I haven't seen it, but I have a deep respect for Steve, not just for the products that he made and the way that he changed the world with those products and with Apple, but for the way that he stood up for what he believed in. You know, when he came back to Apple and he said that we're going to change it, things by design. And he did. The Apple literally changed industries. And multiple industries. Some companies do that once in a company's history. They've done it multiple times. And, you know, he may have been difficult to get along with. He may have been harsh. I respect him. Respect him for all of it.
Mm. Agreed.
Yeah, I mean, a documentary about any one of us,
yeah,
there are things we'd really love to suppress with fire. I just wanted to add to what I said earlier that I'm more pleased with seeing a documentary with we're seeing his own face and his own words fiction. And we're talking. Yes. The thing is, we don't need to talk about fictional versions of Steve Jobs yet. There's still a world filled with people who knew him personally and worked with him and have their own perspectives, but their perspectives informed from working side by side with them for years and years and years. That's why of all the Steve Jobs movies proposed and actually scheduled for release, this is the one I'm probably most interested in actually seeing.
You agree, Renee? Yeah,
I'm of two minds on this kind of stuff because documentaries, much like reality TV, are storytelling. So we can never get an accurate portrayal of somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you don't know it, you know, it's one thing. If you do know it and you agree with it or disagree with it, it's another. I'm lucky enough to have spoken to a lot of people who had very dear memories of Steve Jobs who don't want to see any of these movies because they're afraid that they'll taint the memories that they do have, both good and bad, because it won't be their experience. And I can really understand that. So I'm kind of happy that the industry gets this kind of attention, that Steve Jobs is an important enough person that we have multiple movies being made. And to Jim's point, I mean, the music industry, Pixar, all these different ways that what he put his mind to affected our lives. But at the end, I think I'm just going to get Steve Jobs fatigue.
Is there anything more to say about Steve? I mean, is there an anecdote we haven't heard? Video we haven't seen. I feel like
to the point where I just read, even now people still bring out the Steve, what would Steve Jobs do thing in articles about Apple, and it's gotten to the point where I just find that exhausting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I also
and it's inaccurate too when people do that when they bring out, because we don't know what Steve would have done. Nobody knows what Steve would have done because he changed his mind.
Yes, yeah,
a lot too. You know, we brought up a point earlier about the iPad Mini where he said he was never going to do it.
iTunes on Windows.
Yeah, iTunes on. I mean, Steve did a lot of things based on here and now. So if anybody says. I mean, there was one story I remember just a while ago where a writer at The Guardian said that Steve Jobs never would have released a watch. Well, Steve did release a watch. He released several of them, and we're all old enough to remember that. But, you know, the fact is nobody can realistically say that and mean it.
Yeah. Because Steve himself reversed positions so many times.
Yeah. Well, I would kind of be even just as happy if there weren't any documentaries about him for another 10 years. It takes a while for perspective to really seep in. But it's also in the first 5 or 10 years after a great person's death, a lot of this stuff becomes entrenched and really, really hard to shift in the public imagination. I think one of the least well-reported parts of Apple history is the fact that, yeah, there were times where Steve Jobs was very bullheaded, and part of why he was such a good CEO is that he hired people who were not afraid to say, okay, Steve, you're wrong. We're going to keep on you about this because this is going to be important. And eventually he would see what was proven to be the correct way. But unfortunately, a lot of the dialogue is, well, because he saw the idea on the tree, he plucked it ripe and he stuck it right in his pocket, and we're all the better for
it. He's going to be Sir Isaac Newton eventually. There's nothing you could do about it. But we lived in his time, and I don't know. I can't get enough of it. I agree
with you.
I love this stuff, even though I've heard every story, I think, by now. I loved reading Becoming Steve Jobs, and at the end at his funeral, when they talk about the funeral, I got all teary again. Yeah. You know, we were lucky to live in a time that included Steve Jobs. I mean, I think that's the case. And there's some others I put in that statement, Elon Musk, there's others, but we were very lucky to live in a time when he was alive and to get to benefit from his genius. I'm glad I didn't have to work for him. I don't know if I'd survived that, but there are probably people who say that about me too. Not the first part, the second part. We do know one thing, at least according to a article in Medium. Steve did not like SeekPod. The creator of SeekPod, Casey and Franks, wrote a article, "How Apple Influenced the Labels to Shut Down My Music Streaming Startup." You may remember SeekPod, SeekPod. It goes back to the earliest days of the iPod. 50 million active users every month, 250 million searches every month. Of course, the searches you were making for songs often turned up pirated versions of those songs. Warner Music ended up suing and putting SeekPod out of business. According to this story, Warner told SeekPod's founder that Steve Jobs recommended that they put SeekPod out of business. It was a different time.
Oh, yeah. Well, also SeekPod was already, they were really dancing on that line.
Yeah.
Because
kind of like Grooveshark, right?
Well, people were not using that service to find public domain jazz records from 1903.
Right.
They were doing it to find copyrighted music that they didn't have to pay for.
Right.
So it might, I don't know anything about Apple's or Steve Jobs' involvement in this, but it's not as though here was a rich, vibrant thing that was going to transform the industry that was certainly going to sail right along for interference. No, they were going to have some problems before they got to success.
Apple currently under investigation by the FTC. Music streaming services have been hit with subpoenas. The feds are looking at Apple's 30% share of music sales. I don't understand why that's an issue. I do see that people like Spotify might be irritated by Apple trying to kill their free streaming tier, and that was the initial investigation.
Yeah, to me, that's what a lot of this came down to was trying to kill that free streaming. But it makes sense that Apple would want that done, but also that's maybe what the government is saying. That's not really cool. You know, you can't really do stuff like that. So I don't know how much trouble they would get in for something like that, for making a suggestion that why don't you get rid of a free tier and put everybody on the same level. Don't know. But
the issue, I guess, is that Spotify, RDO, Rhapsody, Tidal normally charge $10 a month for subscriptions, but when they're on iOS, they need to make up the lost revenue, so they charge 30% more.
There's no room for two middlemen. So if you have an agreement with the labels where you have to give them a portion of that money, Apple is the only middleman when it comes to iTunes music. So they just give their 30%. But when you have two middlemen, it's sort of like if you sell a product at Walmart, typical retail deals are around 55%. Walmart keeps a majority of the money. But if you had a second reseller inside Walmart, you would get even less of that money. And then you would complain saying, hey, it's not fair. But that's the way middlemen work. It's very hard to have a relationship where there's multiple people
involved. That's why I can't, for instance, buy audiobooks within the Audible app on the iPhone, but I can within the Audible app on Android because, you know, Google doesn't take 30%, but Apple will if you buy
their business model is very different than Apple's.
Yeah. So, but is that anti-competitive? I mean, I guess everybody wants to be on the iPhone. In a way, that's the success of the iPhone.
Well, I think that the reason that they're just investigating at this point is to see if it was going to be any competitive. I don't think that they've really made up their mind whether it was or not.
That's right.
So, you know, depending on how those discussions go, you know, they could slap Apple with something, but that's going to be a prolonged court case regardless if they decide to do something. What? But, you know, nothing ever happened. So they really don't have that competitive advantage that they're trying to investigate. So they're investigating them talking about it, I guess.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, the 30% markup of that the 30% Apple tax that Apple charges, it's I don't think that Apple doesn't need to get rid of it, but it's always going to create complications. To me, the big one is that it's just so complicated to buy anything through the App Store unless you're dealing with a company that's already making like an 80% markup and they can afford to give away 30% of their profits. It still bumps me out that, you know, every Wednesday I have to go to comixology.com, make my purchases on a web page, and then come back in. When I'm using a Windows device, when I'm using an Android device, it's almost like off-putting, like, you know, 2001 when the ape like looks at that bone and says, wait a minute, I can make an in-app purchase within the app. I don't have to leave and go to the web. Hallelujah. Yeah.
What if the FTC said to Apple, look, you can't do it?
It's going to be super interesting because Apple's always said they run the App Store at a slight profit. Now they run it at a bigger profit, but Apple doesn't want to run it at a loss. And that's why they're careful about the 30% thing is just broad. There are some concessions on the Apple TV, but mostly it's just 30% because that way you can make a free app and put it in an app purchase. You can make a free app and have web downloads. But if those things had less than 30%, very few people would be stupid enough to actually make a premium app anymore. They would just take the money in the economy outside of the App Store, and then Apple would be providing the platform and all the distribution channels for an app that they made no money off of, and almost everything that could would just go free with transactions being held elsewhere. And then that's not a sustainable model for Apple. Like, yes, they're an incredibly rich company and they could pay for it out of the profit. They could subsidize it with hardware profits.
But it's still a loser.
Or something else. Yeah, but they want it to operate at cost, and that means that any app that does make money is helping support the entire ecosystem, including apps that are free.
Well, I don't know if that's exactly what would happen. Any company that has to make money is going to be making money outside of Apple anyway. So Apple is already not seeing a penny off of my comic book purchases, and I just hope it's something that Apple continues to look at when it comes to how can they make the experience better for users, because that's. There are principles that guide and inform every single decision Apple makes, and sometimes they listen to that more loudly than they than on some things than others. But it's always: is there a way we can make this easier for consumers? And having to leave an app in order to make a purchase is leave a reader app to make a purchase, then go back into the reader app to enjoy that purchase. That kind of sucks for users. So I hope they come back to that choice later on.
I hope they make an exception because right now digital goods are accepted. For example, if there's an Amazon app and you order a book, like an actual physical book.
100% of that.
No, they don't. And there could be an argument, and it's looking like they're doing this for Apple TV, and hopefully it'll propagate, where they come to an arrangement where if you're selling a digital good, maybe it's not 30% anymore. Maybe it's 5% or 10%, especially if you're doing your own fulfillment. And then there maybe would be room for multiple middlemen, and it wouldn't be an all-or-nothing deal for anybody.
Yeah, I understand why Apple would need to make money if they use bandwidth. But they require, if you're using the in-app purchases on the iPhone, we're gonna get 30% of that. And then, but then they have some exceptions, so it's very nice.
Yeah, I mean, if they were another way where they can say, well, what if we're not going to be using Apple services to deliver the content. Yeah. We're still going to be serving it from our own paycheck. We just charge you a transaction fee just for the transaction for handling access to the iTunes store. Yeah.
There you go. I'll give you a nickel.
And the platform trust that comes with it, which is valuable for a lot of people.
Well, I don't know how you feel about Magenta, but T-Mobile is definitely doing something that will make iPhone users on T-Mobile happy. They are not going to charge you for bandwidth you use, 3G or LTE bandwidth you use to listen to Apple Music. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Some net neutrality craziness.
It does sound a little like it's a net neutrality issue, but okay. Yeah. As long as Apple's not giving the money to do that, if they're just saying, hey, this is good for us, that's different, right? Then it's not net neutrality.
Well, it's also a sign of how competitive carriers have become now. Right. No one feels as though they're locked in anything. I went back in when I went into reprovision my Android SIM card because I was switching back to the iPhone for my Apple Watch testing. It was the first time that I'd really re-looked at my bandwidth plans, and so I took that time to say, well, let's take a look at everything that I'm doing right now. And it was like in the 3 years since I'd signed up for my plan, I was able to get three times more bandwidth for the same amount of money. I was able to get a better deal on text. I was going to get a better deal on everything else, because that's exactly how and all without having to sign up for an extended contract. And that's how competitive things have gotten now. I think we're going to see more stuff like this where maybe far, far short of a company giving you free Netflix streaming over broadband.
Right.
But I mean, it's so inexpensive to give access to Google Music or to Amazon streaming music, that it's like, we'll just give that to you.
This is why we wanted competition. We didn't want to, carriers to merge. And we wanted, four carriers, and the weaker carriers have to compete harder. They're actually, I didn't realize this, but there are 33 services that stream free on T-Mobile. Apple Music is just the newest of them.
And we're seeing, and Apple users are benefiting from the proliferation of really cheap, unlocked, carrier-free Android phones that are starting to scare the carriers a lot, even in the United States, because now, even just this morning, Motorola announced a really good $179 new version of the Moto G that is going to address the needs of about 85 to 90% of people who use a mobile phone, and it's $179. You own it, and at the drop of a hat, if you want to, if you don't like who they hired for AT&T's ads this month, you decide, I don't want to ever see I didn't like that guy's last movie, I'm going to switch to Sprint, or I'm going to switch to T-Mobile just on that basis. You can do that now, and it's the sort of thing that really improves things for everybody, even iPhone users.
He didn't US say in this blog post free. I'm not clear if Android phones get the free
it's the Nordiques, and then it's US only.
Yeah, because the style is US only phone, right? Like that's just garbage to me.
That's the third rail of any conversation with Renee.
Well, now we got two Canadians over here, so
it's part of a cut. Like, it sounds funny because a lot of people in America say, "Well, we have this and this and this," and you have so many consumer choices. And you come outside America, and I can't even get an Amazon Echo or Amazon MP3. So some of the products that you guys are saying is not very good. I'm switching to this. I can't even do that.
Here's what you can stream free.
We like you, so we're not supposed to tell you this. So everybody else who's not outside this conversation, turn off your speakers. But see. We're trying to lure really cool tech people like yourself to the United States. If we work with Jim,
I'm moving in next to Jim.
Hey, by the way, it's not just Apple Music. I'm looking at the list of 33 services. It includes Google Music, RDO, Songza, Slacker, Spotify, Rhapsody, iHeartRadio, Pandora. I didn't know this, and I'm a T-Mobile customer. Yep. That's a big list. And this doesn't cost you. They're also, and maybe this is the tit for tat that Apple is getting for them. T-Mobile is going to let you upgrade for free if you buy an iPhone 6 today through T-Mobile. You'll get whatever the next iPhone is free. Just swap it.
reality. That's the other interesting part about all this. Now that AT&T and all the other major carriers have stopped using language like, oh, this is a $199 phone, and of course you understand that you're going to be, you will get the money back from all the services that we're going to sell you over the course of a 2-year contract. Now they're explicitly saying, no, this is a $699 phone, and we'll just simply charge you on installments month after month after month. It's harder for people to not understand how much they're paying for each phone. And once you start telling them, here is a $650 phone versus here is a $179 phone, I'm not sure if it's enough to get someone to switch from iOS to Android. But if you get someone who is largely indifferent, who just wants a phone and just cares about, do I get Spotify? Yes. Do I get my book reader? Yes. Do I get access to these to Facebook Messenger? Yes. Okay, then I'm good. I'm interested to see if Apple ever finds a need to address that, or if they are the premium brand that people will pay extra for, and they don't care that that's a $400 more for this phone.
They're also going to jump you ahead of the line on the next generation iPhone. He says, this is John Ledger, CEO of T-Mobile. If there's a new iPhone this year, you're first in line. When you order your upgrade during the first 48 hours it's available, we'll give your order priority and ship it first, along with others who qualify for priority access. So, and they're doing, if you get a 16-gig iPhone 6, it's $15 a month, amortized, or forever, I don't know.
He's the only one with slugs in his blog post as colorful as Jim's.
They're very magenta. Jim doesn't use magenta.
No, but he uses similar language.
What am I missing? What other stories do we have in the rundown? The Beta 5 El Capitan came out. Anything new or exciting in there?
Better. Just better. Getting better.
We're on target for what? When's that going to come out? Fall?
October. Yeah. If they follow the same pattern they followed the last
one. And iOS 9 will come out in October or no, when the new iPhones
September,
come out.
Yeah.
September. Okay.
Yeah. But the cool thing worth mentioning is that Apple has listened to a lot of people and said, okay, guess what? If you're running a beta on iOS, you can't leave App Store reviews for anything.
Yes.
That's great.
Yes.
You can still leave star ratings, which is
a long time coming.
Yeah, grow up.
You can still leave star ratings, which is a little bit annoying, but they got rid of the reviews at least. Hopefully they close that as well.
Yeah.
Because it's the one stars that hurts them.
I have a counterphone iPhone 6 and 6 Plus from China. I bet you it came from that factory that the Chinese police for some reason shut down. It's been going on for years.
I had to I had to ping Jim yesterday and explain to him that it wasn't the Galaxy S6 factory. It took me about 2 minutes to make that clear.
Yeah, it's called Samsung. Oh, no. 41,000.
Shocked to learn the counterfeit Apple phones are being manufactured here.
I'm shocked.
Tapped dead.
Shocked. 41,000 fake iPhones worth as much as $19 million. They've arrested 9 suspects. I don't know what happened. I thought they'd paid everybody off, but apparently not.
Yeah. There's an interesting story behind that one because
you're paid off until you're not.
More.
Yeah. So I should actually, it's in my drawer, but I have the funny thing is these counterfeits look very, very real. But when you boot them up, they look like they're running iOS until you hit the App Store and then it's Google.
Yeah. Play. Or the Chinese, it's the Chinese apps. Android.
No, it's Google. Well, maybe because of me. I don't know.
Well, sometimes I've seen ones that are essentially Android. I've seen ones that run something that's weird that I haven't seen. But you
go get mine.
Holding it in your hand. I've seen iPhone 6s where you hold it in your hand and you just don't know what you're holding. And even when you fire it up, the screen is really, really good. You have to drill at least a level down into the user interface before you start seeing, you know, Linux.
It costs Apple billions of dollars to make the first one, but after that, it's not that expensive to make the same manufacturing processes in China.
Again, for a lot of people, it's a fashion brand. You just want to have that. You just want to have a device that has that logo on it. Just like a lot of people don't care if they have an Yves Saint Laurent bag. They just want a bag that has Yves Saint Laurent logos on it. So even if they're not even. I was in China, I actually wanted to buy it. I will never pronounce this name correctly. Tag Heuer, H-A-U-E-R. Yeah. I pronounced it once and someone told me I was pronouncing it wrong. So this is canonically pronounced wrong. I would have proudly told people, this is my fake Tag watch that I bought for $63. And it's a knockoff of the $1,000 one. Not because I want to fake people into thinking that I've got the real thing, but because, hey, look at me. I've got the thing that really looks cool on your wrist.
One of my earliest memories from being in Hong Kong as a kid is buying my jeans in one store and then buying whatever label I wanted in the store next door.
Yes.
That's how it worked.
So here's the, this is the iPhone 6. It even, so the guy who brought me this from China said he paid, I think, $111 for it. It's not, it's not charged up. And by the way, it holds a charge for about 5 minutes. And he said, but it doesn't say iPhone. At first, you have to bring it across the street. And then they paint iPhone on it. This is what, a 5?
You can also get a banana logo if you want to pay more.
5S. And then I think this is a fake Galaxy.
Yeah.
And then here's, this is the funniest one. This is a fake Windows phone. But on the back, it says Android. So, but it does say 41 megapixel, which I'm thinking was curious, is probably not true.
4.6 megapixel.
That's a very odd phenomenon. That's like getting a knockoff Emerson stereo receiver.
I mean, getting a knockoff Samsung? Yeah, knockoff of a knockoff. Actually, this might be a real Samsung. I can't remember.
Wow. Are the ports aligned, Leo? Just check for that.
It's hard to tell. Yeah, I think that actually is a Note 3. But anyway, they're all in the same drawer. But that one's pretty impressive. If you hold it in the same hand as your iPhone 6, it's pretty hard to tell the difference. Except that it's Android.
My watch just told me it's time to stand up.
Stand up, Jim. We're going to take a break. When you sit down, if you have a pick or a tip you'd like to pass along to our fine audience, we'll give you a chance to do that. We're going to wrap things up here in just a second. Our show today brought to you by Wealthfront. We have many sponsors. Everybody's standing up. It's 12:50, right? Why is it that they don't stagger that?
There's no intelligence applied at all yet.
There's none. I mean, you could be standing up and I'll tell you to stand up.
You could be in a car. It's not so it's mislabeled. It doesn't want you to stand. It wants you to move. So that should actually be called move. Move should be called exercise. And exercise should be called burn or something. They just need to shift all those labels across.
It's funny. I mean, I've got two people in the audience who are standing up. I wonder if, like, at conferences and events now, if at 10 minutes to the hour, every hour, people just stand up and start moving around. I don't know. We should do this from now on all of our shows.
It happened at WWC keynote. All of a sudden, a bunch of us got, the alarm went off and we're all just looking at each other.
Oh, that's so funny.
We thought they'd make a gag out of it and say, okay, everyone, here's your time. Stand up for a minute. Now we're going to go back. But no,
it's so funny. Our show today brought to you by Wealthfront, the company that I cannot, due to SEC regulations, use. Almost all of our advertisers, I am a customer, not Wealthfront, although I will be the minute they stop advertising. This is such a great idea. Everybody knows that you should be investing at least some of your savings for long-term, for you and your family's financial health, a rainy day retirement. Chances are a lot of people go to an advisor, and an investment advisor is going to charge you as much as 1% to 3% of what you've got under management. And then there's additional fees for transactions and changes. I know I've experienced this personally. Wealthfront doesn't do that. It's computerized. It's amazing. It makes it easy for anyone to get world-class long-term investment management. You could set it up in minutes. You'll use their software to monitor your portfolios around the clock. Wealthfront will do this trading. One of the managers is the guy who wrote that Random Walk Down Wall Street, which is one of my Bibles. It's brilliant. But it does it all for you. You don't have to do it. Which is awesome. Plus, they do some pretty sophisticated stuff like tax loss harvesting and direct indexing, which optimize your after-tax returns and lower your tax bill. I mean, this is really clever. Transparent and accessible. You can see all your accounts in one place. You can have personal. You can have joint. You can have retirement. You can see every trade they make on your behalf. Remember, this is long-term. This is not day trading. The idea is to build your wealth every month, every year. You pay, and this is the best part, 0.25% per year, 25 basis points. And there are no commissions. There are no hidden charges. I'm talking less than $5 a month to invest $30,000. And you can just try it if you want, because they've lowered the minimum to set up an account to $500. They've grown 20 times. What is that? 2,000% over the last 2 years. Now, $2.4 billion being managed by Wealthfront, because it's a brilliant idea. It's kind of the Silicon Valley answer to the investment advisor. Wealthfront.com/MacBreak. We're going to give you a special deal here. You can sign up there, get a free personalized investment portfolio, see what they would be investing you in, and decide whether you want to participate. And if you do give them money, you can get your first $15,000 managed entirely fee-free free of charge for life. Wealthfront is a great idea. Wealthfront.com/MacBreak. If you check into it, read the books, see what they're doing, get your portfolio, you will be, I think, very impressed. And the price, boy, I mean, there's no better way to do this. We're talking 0.25% a year. For compliance purposes, I have to tell you, Wealthfront Incorporated is an SEC-registered investment advisor. Brokerage services are offered through Wealthfront Brokerage Corporation, member FINRA and SIPC. This is not a solicitation to buy or sell securities. Investing in securities involves risks, and there is the possibility of losing money. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Please visit Wealthfront.com to read their full disclosure. Wealthfront.com/MacBreak. It's pick of the week time. Let's start with Renee Ritchie today.
So this is an app that's been around for a while, but and I've sort of been vaguely aware of it. But I saw John August, who makes the app. John August, he wrote a lot of Hollywood movies like Big Fish and Charlie's Angels and things like that. And he also develops iOS apps, and he makes some really good ones.
Wow.
And this one is sort of one of the smaller apps that he makes, but it's called Weekend Read. And it's exactly what the name implies. It comes with some content, some scripts mainly. And every weekend he makes new scripts available. And last weekend it was the Social Network script by Aaron Sorkin.
Oh, that's good. I've read that. Yeah.
Yeah. The minute I saw that, it was just easy buy, easy download. And every week you'll tweet out and you'll see inside the app. It is great because the weekend is, it really is sort of like the problem you're solving on the weekend is boredom. It's the weekend, you have some time, you want something interesting to read. You don't care about the 19th recycling of the same text story. You want something different, maybe a little bit artistic. And this just, it has a great diversity, great content. I love reading scripts. He always picks really good selections. And it's just, it's something that I look forward to now every Friday. So it's available on the App Store. It's a couple bucks. Well worth it. And John August again picks great scripts every
week. What a great idea. I mean, if you're into movies and if you're a film buff, reading the scripts is great. And by the way, they have iPhone and iPad version, so that's nice.
Universal binary.
And how much are the scripts?
It's all free. So as long as you've bought the app.
What? You get
those, as long as you're paying attention. So they come in on Friday. I believe they leave Sunday night. So you have to pay attention to get them on the weekend. Literally, it is a weekend read.
Oh, I get it.
Yeah.
That's neat. So $11.99 for Weekend Read Unlimited, and that's you pay that once, and that's it. It's free to download and try. Love it. Good pick.
I enjoyed reading the weekend scripts this week. It was great.
Jim, you got a pick or something you'd like to share with us?
I do. I would like to share an app that I've been using for the last year in helping with my fitness and weight loss called MyFitnessPal.
Love it.
Yes.
I use it too. Love
it. It's a great app just to, you can search food. You can use a UPC label scanner, the camera on your iPhone. And again, it's not something that you have to be religious about, but it's information. The more information you have, the better decisions you can make. Or, you know, you can choose to ignore it. Whenever I do bad things, like eat, you know, more than I should or drink more than I should, I still put it all in there.
I think that's a
good
idea.
Just to track it.
Yep.
And it's great for doing that.
It'll also track exercise, and it's got a social component.
Yeah, so, I don't use the social component.
Oh, I was going to say, what's your handle? I'd like to follow you. I've got Dr. Mom, who is in our chat room, follows me. She's my online doctor, so she'll give me pats in the back or berate me. Maybe that's maybe I shouldn't use this social component. No, I love this app. Lisa, it was impressive. Lisa went on we went on a cruise a couple of weeks ago, a 2-week cruise, and Lisa wrote everything down the whole time.
She's amazing.
She lost 4 pounds on the cruise. I could kill her.
Oh.
I gained 4 pounds on the cruise. So, yeah, MyFitnessPal, it's great. It's owned by Under Armour. It's free, right, Jim? I think it is, yeah.
Yeah, there is a new
I did the pro eight- level.
Paid yeah. component for the pro, but yeah, the basis of it is all free.
Yeah, yeah, very nice stuff. I don't know if any of you use the command line, but this is a very geeky tip.
The terminal.
Let me open up my terminal because I have installed now the default terminal on OS X, like Ubuntu and a lot of other Unix like operating systems, is Bash, the born again shell. But it's very Unix-y in its configuration and all of that. There's a new one that I really like called Fish. which stands for the Friendly Interactive Shell. Let me go to the fish webpage here. By the way, there's a Loop Insight. That's a good recommendation.
Such a great site.
Great site, even with the purple. just teasing.
It's Samuel Jackson and Jim Dalrymple. They both
own
purple.
Let me do fish. Look for the fish command line shell. It's at fishshell.com. It's, you know, I mean, if you're used to Bash, you'll be fairly comfortable with a lot of the, you know, if you use the command line, it's not going to blow you away. But it does some stuff like things like coloring syntax. It does great auto suggestions, so it kind of knows what you're... I love what they say, the command line shell for the 90s. But that's because most shells are really for the 70s. They go back a few. I really like it. It has a function command that prompts are programmable by function. It's some really impressive stuff. Man page completions mean it's easy to find out what the commands are. It does run on Windows and Linux, but if you're an OS X user, you can install it in three ways. There's a standalone app. So if you don't want to kind of mess with your own, you know, your setup, you can just run the standalone app, and it's a terminal program, and you can run the shell and see how you like it. You can also install it into a user local, or if you're a brew user, Homebrew has a very simple command line, brew install fish. Once you install it, it's friendly, it's easy, it's got a great help command. And you see, as soon as I start typing, it suggests commands. It's really a great way to get into the command line. Very easy to customize the prompt as well. You know, I know this is kind of a geeky recommendation, but I've been using it for a couple of months now, and I really like it. Fish Shell, free, fishshell.com. And if you do shell scripting, I think you'll really like the features in Fish. Andy and Akko. Sorry?
I don't know if we mentioned it. That reminds me. I don't know if we mentioned it, but Coda for iOS came out, which is also geek.
Yes.
Terminally yeah. Wonderful.
It used to be Coda. What it was? Coda?
Diet Coda on the
Diet Coda. Coda. Yep. Yeah. Panic does great software. And Coda is a, if you do web coding of any kind, it's great. Love Coda.
That's such a great example of the, I want to be able to do all my work on an iPad. And if you are, if you're a web manager, if you're a web designer, that's like, I've got this app. It's even better than many of the tools that are on the desktop. It's a great app. I'm sorry. We lost one of the greatest app names in App Store.
Diet Coda.
But still.
Andy, what do you got?
I've got one of those contemplative sort of like meditational games, puzzle games. It's called Prune, and it's got the simplest premise where
I love it.
At the bottom of the ground, there is a tree that is growing, and it's growing towards the light. As it grows, you need to, by using a fruit ninja sort of swipe, cut away branches that are preventing it from reaching the light. And so it's simple premise, but it gets so interesting to manipulate it. And sometimes there are things that are throwing shade that you have to sort of convince it to grow around. And once the branches start to find the sunlight, flowers start to appear. And now you can sort of get it to grow towards these little like energy sort of things and make it grow even better. But as you can see from this graphics, it's just, you almost are okay with just leaving that streaming to your Apple TV as a screensaver, because it's just beautiful graphic design. And even though it is a game, and there is, it keeps growing and growing and growing, whether you want it to stop or not. I never get into that situation where I feel myself getting more panicked and more, you know, keyed up. I play games to relax, because I've got enough stress in my work life that I don't want to go get the med pack. Oh, God damn it! So this is one of those things where I can relax. I can be a vessel of peace and love as I'm encouraging lively things to grow. And another thing I like about it is that it's $3.99. So they're actually charging money commensurate with the amount of effort they put into it. I like to see value put onto these sort of things. I think it's part of the great training process of training people to actually spend money on apps, as opposed to this should be free, stupid, one star.
Yeah, and you don't have to buy a bunch of levels.
Yeah, no, it's branches. Just you own the game and you play the game and...
Yeah, I like it. Yep. Wow, this is it. We're done, kids. But I hope you had a good time, Jim Dalrymple, and I hope you'll come back now that you know the way.
I had a great time. Anytime you want me here, I'm here.
It's a deal.
Yay.
It's a deal. Of course, you can catch Jim many other podcasts. Do you do any on a regular basis?
I do the Dalrymple Report with Merlin Mann. Merlin's a
so
lot of
jealous.
Fun.
Oh,
a lot
man.
Of fun. I love that guy.
He used to be a regular on this show, and then he abandoned us for you.
And then I
he quit it. Then a quick 4 years later, right at Jim's place.
Yeah, yeah,
bastard.
Yeah. Well, we knew what the plan was all along.
Along amplified.
Is that on 5x5?
Yeah.
Okay. Amplified along with Anaco's Almanac and Renee, any day now we'll be doing one there too. That Dan Benjamin, yeah. I'll tell you, he is a go-getter. Wow, he's added more shows. Holy cow! Great. And of course, loopinsight.com. That's the place where you'll catch Jim's writings on a regular basis.
Yes.
And he is, there is no better, more astute observer of the Apple scene. So
thank
it's
you.
Great to have you. Well, if there is one, it'd be Renee Ritchie at imore.com. I always go there when I can't figure out how to use things like Apple Music or the Apple Watch. Those tutorials are fantastic.
We love to explain. That's our raison d'etre.
Yeah. I feel like you found a niche there with that. That's just great.
Thanks to really Andy and Jim and John and Jason are huge, Leo, like huge influences on us. And I think you guys helped us find our way there.
Good. Well, and of course, great podcast too.
Send me a check.
I just buy you beer and you're happy.
You don't need to get your check.
Beer.
Get beer.
I got coffee mugs. Yeah,
can't drink
I
a
don't
check.
Drink coffee, but I put things into things.
If you go to the show's page, you'll see more podcasts all the time, including, of course, Debug, which is awesome. Every week, great shows from Mobile Nations and imore.com. Andy Anaco, has your watch review appeared in the Chicago Sun-Times yet?
No, not yet, because I understand I do need to get hopping on that one. I find that, you know, after about a month, I had a decent review ready. After about 2 weeks after that, I felt like, oh, now I understand it. And now that it's been 2 months, it's like, I know exactly what I want to say. I felt as though I don't trust, honestly, any wearable, particularly Apple Watch. Do not trust any review that comes out after only about a week or two of experience with it, because you really do have to wear it for an entire month and also be prepared to realize that your expectations were not necessarily correct. And so before you can judge it on what it is. So I'm hoping it's going to be out in the next 10 days. But I'm really, really pleased with the drafts that I have right now, because my goal is just to, every time I write a review, is to make sure that there's a reason for it to exist. And I think that there'll be a reason for this one to exist.
Absolutely. And we look forward to it. You could follow Andy, not only at the Chicago Sun-Times, at his website, CWOB.com, and on the Twitter, INATKO. Thank you all for being here. We do Mac Break Weekly every Tuesday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC. If you can watch live, that's great, because the chat room is always a lot of fun, and it's very helpful to me. But if you can't be live and in the chat room, you can always be live in studio if you're going to be in Petaluma sometime. Yeah, that's where the geniuses come. All you have to do is email tickets at twit.tv, and we'll put a chair out for you. Maybe put a cupcake under it. And if you can't do either of those on demand, no, I'm sorry, I lied. He looked. Made you look. We had cupcakes. There may actually be some still in the kitchen. We had. This is the fourth. Or this weekend was the fourth anniversary of our move into the studio, so we had some cupcakes.
Congratulations!
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to say, if there's cupcakes, I'm coming up.
Yeah, cupcakes and Heineken. There's nothing like it.
Yeah, be careful, Leo. It's not that far anymore.
Where do you live now, Jim?
I'm in Palo Alto.
What?
Yep.
Oh, you're probably next door to Kevin Marks. You're both broadcast outside from the backyard.
Yeah.
We got it. Next time, come up. I'd love to have you in the studio. And I will arrange for cupcakes if you should choose. But we'll get extra special low-calorie cupcakes.
Heineken.
Well, that kind of takes the fun out of it.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
Well, maybe we've hit upon like a good reason for Force Touch to exist. Like, you can actually just like stand on it with one foot and get like a weight sort of reading. Apple will probably wind up selling a lot more watches that way as we keep breaking them.
Well, I'm sorry. The cupcake is a lie. There's no cupcakes. You can get on-demand versions of this show after the fact. twit.tv/MBW, but also wherever podcasts are. A lot of people listen on their podcast app on their iPhone or whatever you happen to have handy. I thank you for being here. Now, my friends, you'd best get back to work, because break time is over.